child abuse left him brain damage with severe mental impediments. He was executed despite having an IQ of only 68, below the threshold of what is considered intellectually disabled. Dobby Gillis Williams, another man who suffered from intellectual disability, was killed on January 8, 1999. For his final meal, he ate 12 candy bars and a bowl of ice cream. Gerald Bordelon, who, during his execution, wore a gold cross that his daughter had given him just hours before, turned to the family of his victim in the moments before he was killed, looking at them through the glass, and said, "I'm sorry. I don't know if that brings any closure or peace. It should have never happened, but it did, and I'm sorry." Each of these three men were found guilty of taking someone's life. But standing in this room, I couldn't understand how taking their lives in return made things any better. We filed back onto the bus without saying much of anything. The engine started, and the bus's rubber tires spit out clouds of dust behind them. Earlier, we had visited the law library and the automotive tech shop, where we met John, a 53-year-old who was in charge of the vocational training program. More than 30 years into a life sentence, he spoke thoughtfully about how, though it seemed unlikely he would ever be released, his work made it possible to provide mentorship and life skills to men who would be going back into society. It helped give his life a sense of purpose. The law library was filled with dozens of bookshelves containing old legal texts and small carrels tucked away between them, where books and casework could be stored. Here, we listened to three men describe their experiences working in the library. I was not allowed to bring any recording device inside the building itself, but I remember how they spoke of the way the law library helped them reclaim a sense of agency, how learning the law made them feel as if they still had control over something in their lives. I've spent the past several years teaching in prisons and jails, and the tables spread out across the law library reminded me of so many of the classrooms where I had worked with incarcerated writers. As I listened to the men speak about their experiences, it was impossible not to think of all the stories my own students had shared with me about living inside a cage. It felt incredibly important to hear directly from people incarcerated in Angola, but having an official employed by the prison present us with seemingly pre-selected speakers lent the impression that the men were giving us presentations they had given on many other occasions to many other visitors. I imagine there was little chance that these men would say anything unfavorable about the prison in front of a prison representative. Such dissent could lead to retribution. There is a long precedent for that. As such, there will always be a limit to the amount of candor an incarcerated person can provide in such a space. After listening to the men, we returned to the bus. I sat in the fourth row of seats as the shuttle rattled along a narrow dirt road, gravel crackling underneath us. As the bus rolled on, I thought of how slavery, the history of which Angola is inextricably linked with, was only being alluded to in a sort of offhanded way. Roger stood at the front with a microphone in hand, glancing around to see if anyone had a question as we traveled to our next destination. I cleared my throat. "I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the prison's relationship to slavery." I was nervous to ask the question, and I was ashamed of myself for feeling nervous. Roger paused, then nodded. "He asked me to talk a little bit about the prison's relationship to slavery," he said, repeating my question, perhaps to buy time, or so people in the back of the bus could hear. "I'll tell you this," he began, readjusting the microphone in his hand. "And I told you this when we came in. This was one of the bloodiest prisons in America. It was a horrible prison." His voice was sincere and steady. "On the way out, I'm going to show you the Red Hat cell block," he said, speaking of the prison's infamous maximum security housing unit that closed in 1972. "And we don't make any bones about it. I can't change what happened here when Samuel James took this prison over. He stumbled over his words as he attempted to finish his thought. "They house slaves on this land, and I can't change that. I think it's an interesting situation that we're in. When you go from that, when you're at that level with some of the worst things that have ever happened on a piece of land in America. This 18,000 acres has seen more suffering than any 18,000 acre piece of property in the world, probably. When you look at it, it's horrible. But when you go from that, and you go years and years and years, and you get to where we are today, with the redemption and the change, then that's what I like to talk about. Our history is our history, and I can't change that. Roger went on to share how the prison had sent one of its observation towers to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. The Red Hat cell block was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. More evidence, according to Roger, that the penitentiary was acknowledging its history. He paused, looked around the bus, and smiled. I'll get off my soapbox before moving on to talk about the prison's hospice, which we passed on our left. A wave of whispers made its way around the small bus. Roger's, "I can't change that," seemed to provide the pretense of acknowledgement while creating distance from personal culpability. It was reminiscent of a refrain laced throughout our country's conversations about the history of racism. I thought about all the times growing up when I had sat in a class and heard a white classmate say, "Well, my ancestors didn't own slaves," or heard a political commentator on television say, "Why are we still talking about slavery? People need to get over it." Or a politician say, "We can't wallow in the past. It's time to focus on the future." When I hear these deflections, I think of all the ways this country attempts to smother conversations about how its past has shaped its present. How slavery is made to sound as if it happened in a prehistoric age, instead of only a few generations ago. In his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote that the story the country tells about its relationship to chattel slavery is willfully distorted. Quote, "Our histories tend to discuss American slavery so impartially that in the end, nobody seems to have done wrong and everybody was right. Slavery appears to have been thrust upon unwilling, helpless America, while the South was blameless in becoming its center. One is astonished in the study of history at the recurrence of the idea that evil must be forgotten, distorted, skimmed over. If, in Germany today, there were a prison built on top of a former concentration camp, and that prison disproportionately incarcerated Jewish people, it would rightly provoke outrage throughout the world. I imagine there would be international summits on closing such an egregious institution. And yet, in the United States, such collective outrage at this plantation-turned-prison is relatively muted. It's not that people don't know. Angola Prison has been regularly and casually referred to as a plantation by state authorities and media for over a century. When people say, "Angola is a prison built on a former plantation," it is often made as an unsettling observation, not as a moral indictment. Is it because our collective understanding of slavery and its inherent violence is so limited? Or is it that violence experienced by Black people is thought less worthy of mourning? White supremacy enacts violence against Black people, but also numbs a whole country, Black and white, to what would, in any other context, provoke our moral indignation. I still wasn't satisfied with the answer Roger had provided. So after he had responded to a question from someone else in the group by discussing the positive programming the prison was doing, I raised my hand again. "On that note," I began, "you're showing us lots of, and talking a lot about, some of the stuff that you all do really well, which is wonderful to see. I'm curious about what things you think you all could be doing better." In hindsight, I should have asked my follow-up question more directly. But in the moment, I was concerned with sounding condescending or disrespectful. I was occupying two identities. As a Black man who grew up in Louisiana, I felt a sense of responsibility to demand more from a place that had enacted so much violence on my community. As a PhD student at an Ivy League school, I didn't want to come across as someone who had dropped in to critique a place I had no personal ties to. I didn't want to dismiss the reforms. It's important that prisons are not dangerous for the people kept in them. It's important that people are prepared for life if they leave and allowed the opportunity to live a meaningful life for however long they are in prison. But simply because something has been reformed does not mean it is now acceptable. And even if something is now better, that does not undo its past, nor does it eliminate the necessity of speaking about how that past may have shaped the present. Roger talked about how the prison had no control over what happened in the state legislature, and that it needed that body to pass certain laws in order for them to help prisoners more effectively. He talked about the extremely low recidivism rate for people convicted of murder, but reminded us that without a change in sentencing laws, Angola could not simply release its prisoners. I was astonished by the lack of institutional contrition, the refusal to admit what was right in front of us. I have no way of knowing Roger's intentions, but it was evident that he had little interest in talking about the role slavery had played in shaping Angola, which in its early days had a big house of the old southern plantation style on the grounds, in which the person responsible for all of the people held here, the warden, lived with his family. Some prison employees and their families are also given free housing on the grounds, and well into the 20th century, guards and other prison employees used the labor of those incarcerated for their own personal use. In a book about Angola published in 1990, Patsy Dreher, whose father was a guard captain at Angola, is quoted looking back nostalgically on her time living on the grounds. Angola was a pleasant place to live back then. A vegetable cart came by every morning. What you didn't get in pay, you got in benefits. You could get inmates as cooks, yard boys, house boys. You could have two or three of them if you wanted. We had an old cook named Leon who cried like a baby when he got parole. He said ours was the only home he had known in a long time. I brought up my concerns with Norris. He looked at me and said, "Some people want to let dead dogs lie." But I didn't want that. I wanted the prison to create a sign at the entrance naming that it had been a plantation. I wanted markers erected in the places where incarcerated people had died, and for the first and last sentence of every tour to begin with the word slavery. I wanted Angola, where 71% of people are serving life sentences and 3/4 of the population is black, to not pretend as if that was a coincidence. What I wanted more than anything was for this prison to not be here, holding these people, on this land, with this history. It all felt so profoundly irredeemable. While Roger may have been unwilling to provide more than a perfunctory acknowledgement of the prison's relationship to slavery, the relationship is clear to those who have experienced incarceration themselves. Generations of men who have been incarcerated at Angola or elsewhere have been more than willing to name that connection. Monroe Green, who arrived at Angola in 1957, was explicit. "I saw a big farm. There were a lot of men in the fields. The living conditions were like on those slave ships coming over here, with the quarters filled with slaves." A poem from Mark King in a 1992 issue of Angola's award-winning prison magazine, The Angolite, draws direct comparisons between the brutality of slavery and the conditions and treatment of people in Angola. "A century of forced labor, blood and pain, lives wasted, buried in the shame. Slave masters oversee their daily task, hidden behind century-old sadistic mask. The world has passed this deathly land by. The inhabitants still ask why." In 1998, Chuck Unger said, "The people held in Angola have become modern-day slaves for the state. We work at hard labor for practically nothing, and we make people rich." Incarcerated activist and writer Mumia Abu-Jamal has noted, "If there ever was a question of the slave parentage of the American prison system, one glance at the massive penitentiary known as Angola removes all doubt." In 2000, Lane Nelson, who wrote in the Angolite, observed that Angola's turbulent history is stitched to the present by threads of oppression, where people have been held in bondage on this land for more than 200 years. Uninterested in obscuring the past and its relation to the present, Nelson stated unequivocally that Angola still conjures historical images of Southern slavery. And in 2018, prisoners refused to work after a confrontation between workers and guards. The organization, Decarcerate Louisiana, released a set of demands on behalf of striking workers, including a call for a national conversation on how state prison farms had come to hold so many people of African descent against their will. Quote, "We are urging that local, state, and federal governments who currently hold hundreds of thousands of African Americans on prison farms across the country be investigated for antebellum criminality, involuntary servitude, and slavery." At another stop, the bus came to a halt in the middle of a dirt road that we could not see the end of, that melted into the fields in the distance. On our left were two conjoined buildings, white with red trim. One had black shingles laid across its slanted roof. The buildings were surrounded by chain-link fencing that had been weathered into penny rust and muted silver, messy tangles of barbed wire sitting on top of them. The grass was a puzzle of brown patches, though green enough not to look wholly forgotten. Clouds continued to coat the sky with a thin membrane of light gray as the sun hummed softly behind them. These were the buildings known collectively as the Red Hat Cell Block. The Red Hat Cell Block had been constructed after an attempted escape in 1933. Located in the prison's Camp E, it became Angola's most restrictive and harshest housing facility, a dark scar that rose from the skin of this vast land. 40 cells lined its corridor, each room measuring 5 by 7 feet. The block became known as the Red Hat because when the men went out to work in the fields, they wore straw hats that had been dipped into red paint to make them easily identifiable. As I stepped inside the cell block, the soft echo of my shoes against the floor bounced off the bars of each cell. The cells had heavy sliding steel doors that locked into place against the concrete walls. The sun crept around the door at the opposite end of the corridor, casting long shadows of our bodies onto the floor. I stepped into the first cell on my right and became acutely aware of my body in the confined space. On my left, a slab of gray concrete rose from the floor, a place for the condemned to lay their head. At the opposite end of the slab, and just a few inches to the right, was a small gray sink, wet and discolored, mold blooming in its crevices. Another foot to the right, and low on the wall, was a toilet. The paint on the floor, on the walls, and on the toilet was peeling off from the duress of prolonged exposure to the changing seasons. I stood in the middle of the cell and stretched my arms out. With my left hand, I could run my fingers over the cold, uneven concrete, and with my right hand, I could nearly reach the steel bars of the cell door. This was not the width of the cell. This was the length. I sat at the edge of the concrete slab, and when I extended my legs, I could touch the wall. I lowered my feet again to the ground and let the smallness of the cell wash over me. I looked up at the small square window and the streaks of light scissoring through its 4 vertical bars. I thought of the people who had lived in these cells, who had slept on these slabs. In recollections of their time at the Red Hat, the men who lived there described the cell block as infested with rats and other vermin. Albert Woodfox, who spent 40 years in solitary confinement at Angola, recounts, "There was a toilet in the cell, but they kept the water turned off, so it didn't work. You had to use a bucket in the corner, which could only be emptied when you were let out every few days for a shower. They wanted you to smell the stench of your own body waste while eating." In his memoir, Billy Wayne Sinclair, who was once on death row in Angola, said that the men held on the Red Hat block were given the leftovers from other prisoners' meals, and that those meals were delivered to them in wheelbarrows. Sinclair described the Red Hat during the 1940s and 1950s as Angola's torture chamber, and outlined a culture of violence and callousness, not from the prisoners, but from the guards. Quote, inmates sent to the Red Hat were brutally beaten by convict guards going in, beaten on a daily basis, and beaten coming out. They were fed bread and water twice a day. Some inmates were broken. Others died from abuse and neglect. Some sent to the Red Hats during that era simply disappeared, never to be seen or heard from again. Adjacent to the cell block, and accessible via a small though haunting antechamber, was a single-room building, empty but for the electric chair near its back wall. The original chair is no longer there. It sits in the museum up the road, but a replica sat in its place. I looked around. No one else was in the room with me. I walked over to the chair and sat down. My shoes became draped in a tangle of cobwebs at its base. The chair was long, wooden, and perpendicular. I'm around 6 feet tall, and once I was fully seated, my feet dangled a few inches from the ground. I imagined the leather straps that hung from the arms of the chair being tightened around my forearms and my waist. My dangling feet and my body tied to the chair would create a sense of helplessness, leaving me feeling both heavy and weightless. Next to the chair was an entwinement of wires connected to a box that would produce the fatal electric shocks. Louisiana began using the electric chair in 1941. The original electric chair was known by the men at Angola as Gruesome Gertie. At first, the chair was not based at a single location, but traveled to the parish where the condemned person was in prison. In 1957, however, Gruesome Gertie retired from its traveling and found a home on the Red Hat cell block at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. The chair has the infamous distinction as the site of the country's first botched execution by electrocution. Willie Francis, a 17-year-old black boy from St. Martinville, Louisiana, was placed in the electric chair on May 3, 1946. He was charged with murdering a pharmacist named Andrew Thomas in 1944. But in the decades following his death, serious questions were raised about Willie's culpability. Months after Thomas was killed, the St. Martinville police had failed to apprehend anyone for the murder. St. Martinville sheriff called the chief of police in Port Arthur, Texas, and told him to arrest any man from St. Martinville found in Port Arthur in a last-ditch effort to resolve the case. Willie, visiting one of his sisters in Port Arthur at the time, had been arrested, mistakenly, on a separate drug charge. The charge was dropped, but the police began questioning Willie about Thomas's murder in St. Martinville instead. Soon, police had a signed confession from Willie. The boy had no counsel present. Given his age and the circumstances of his arrest, it is unlikely that such a statement could exist devoid of coercion, threats, or violence from the officers in their interrogation room. Willie pleaded not guilty and was put on trial in front of a jury of 12 white men. Willie's lawyers called no witnesses, refused to make an opening statement, and offered no objections. 2 days after the trial began, Willie was convicted of murder. It took the jury just 15 minutes to deliberate. He was sentenced to death. It is difficult to imagine what a person feels in the moments before they are executed. Willie's words provide a small piece of insight into an otherwise unfathomable experience. Everybody was watching me as I walked out. I looked at the sheriff, and he nodded. So I walked across the room and sat down in the chair. He took the handcuffs off, and the men began strapping me into the chair. They put one strap around my leg and around my waist and tied my arms down too. I knew then how real it was to have to die. I had it in my mind deep. It was so quiet in there. Everybody was looking at me so funny. It was the realest misery I ever knew, to see them watching me. It seemed like they would come close to my eyes and then move away from me. I wish they had kept still because I was already dizzy. I was cold and my hands were all wet. I couldn't feel my neck and my head, but they say I was soaking with perspiration. They kept on fixing the machine and connecting the wires to my head and to my left leg. But the machine Willie was being connected to had been improperly assembled. The prison guard responsible for its assembly, Captain Effie Foster, along with a prisoner assisting him, had been drunk while setting it up earlier that day. As a result, the electrocution did not kill Willie, but it did torture him. Quote, "The best way I can describe it is, wham, zzzz." It felt like 100 and 1,000 needles and pins were pricking in me all over, and my left leg felt like somebody was cutting it with a razor blade. I could feel my arms jumping at my sides, and I guess my whole body must have jumped straight out. I thought for a minute I was going to knock the chair over. Then I was all right. I thought I was dead. Then they did it again. The same feeling all over. I heard a voice say, "Give me some more juice down there." And in a little while, somebody yelled, "I'm giving you all I got now." I think I must have hollered for them to stop. They say I said, "Take it off. Take it off." I know that was certainly what I wanted them to do. Turn it off. I really thought I was dead then. Willie's father found an attorney to take on his son's case. The lawyer argued that subjecting Willie to another attempted execution would amount to cruel and unusual punishment. The case made its way all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Ultimately, the court ruled 5-4 against Willie. He was killed by electric chair just a little over a year later, on May 9th, 1947. Willie recounted the events that led to that moment. Quote, "I know how it feels to have them read a death warrant to me. I know how it feels to sit in a cell, waiting for the day they will lead me to the chair again. I sure know how it feels to sit in that chair and have them strap me in and put a mask on my eyes. I know how it feels to have the shock go through me and think I am dead, but find out I am not. I sat in the chair and thought of Willie Francis's reflection, an observation both profound and devastatingly youthful. Boy, you sure feel funny when you know you're going to die. Almost like you know something only God should know." A few minutes after we entered the Red Hat, we were told it was time to get back on the bus. I kept sitting in the chair and clutched my hands on its rough wooden edges before lifting myself up and walking toward the haze of the door. As I stepped out of the Red Hat, the air smelled like smoke, even though nothing was on fire. Or maybe everything was. At the time of our visit, the state of Louisiana had 69 people on death row, meaning individuals who have been sentenced to death for crimes they have been convicted of. The average person remains on death row for more than a decade as they appeal their sentence or wait to be executed. 2/3 of people on death row in Louisiana are black. An estimated 1 out of every 25 people who are sentenced to death in the United States is innocent. We're the only prison, I'd venture to say, in America that would allow people to visit death row. The other states would never do that. They'd freak out with that, Rogers said proudly as we pulled up to the building where death row prisoners were housed. I'm going to step up a little bit on this soapbox here, and I'm going to throw it out because no one has asked me, Rogers said, though it was unclear what he was alluding to. So one of the things you haven't asked me about is solitary confinement. Solitary confinement does not exist in Louisiana. Solitary confinement denotes solid steel doors devoid of human contact. And I'm going to prove this to you right now when we go to death row. Louisiana had taken steps to make death row a less restrictive experience for the people housed there. Roger implied that the Department of Corrections had done this of their own moral accord. What Roger did not mention was the history of recent lawsuits that appear to have pushed the state to make substantive changes to the way it treated those on death row. In 2013, 3 men on death row sued Angola for appalling and extreme conditions caused by extreme heat. Their attorneys asserted that the conditions of the unit violated the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the 8th Amendment. The lawsuit claimed that during the summer of 2011, the heat index on death row at times reached 195 degrees Fahrenheit. For a staggering 85 days between May and August 2012, the heat index rose above 126 degrees. Death row units did not have any air conditioning systems, only fans. And according to the lawsuit, during the summer, The bars of the cells are hot to the touch, and the cinder block walls release additional heat. It also claimed that the people housed on death row often chose to sleep on the concrete floor of their cells because the floor is slightly cooler than their beds. After 3 years, a federal judge ruled that the prison was in violation of the Eighth Amendment once the heat index surpassed 88 degrees, and the judge required remediation measures to address the heat, though the prison was not forced to install air conditioning units. Later, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit overturned the requirement to keep the heat index of the death row unit below the 88-degree maximum the plaintiffs had urged. In 2016, Jimmy LeBlanc, Secretary of the State's Department of Public Safety and Corrections, claimed that providing air conditioning for people on death row would open a Pandora's box, potentially forcing the state to provide air conditioning to many other prisoners. In 2017, another lawsuit challenged the use of solitary confinement on death row. The suit alleged that forcing people to spend 23 hours a day in a windowless cell with little or no interaction with other people caused severe physical and mental harm. Wilbert Rideau, who spent more than a decade in solitary confinement, described the experience. "I spent 12 years in cells that were variations of solitary confinement. I think I've never before or since felt the bone-cold loneliness that I felt on death row, removed from family or anything resembling a friend, and just being there, with no purpose or meaning to my life, cramped in a cage smaller than an American bathroom. The loathsomeness was only increased by the constant cacophony of men in adjacent cells, hurling shouted insults, curses, and arguments, not to mention the occasional urine or feces concoction. Deprivation of both physical exercise and meaningful social interaction were so severe in the early days of Louisiana's death row that some men went mad, while others feigned lunacy in order to get transferred to the hospital for the criminally insane, where they had freedom of movement, interaction with others, and an escape from their date with the electric chair." Less than 2 months after the lawsuit was filed, the Louisiana Department of Corrections implemented a series of policies that loosened some of the death row restrictions. The department claimed that the lawsuit against the prison was not at all connected to the changes on death row, though the timing is difficult to overlook. Previously, no two people were allowed out of their cells at the same time. Each person had 1 hour a day to walk up and down the tier, take a shower, or make a phone call. They were allowed outside 3 days a week during that single hour in separate fenced-off enclosures, areas that the lawsuit compared to dog cages. When they were allowed to leave their tier, it was often in shackles, no matter the distance they were going. Since May 15, 2017, however, men on death row have been afforded 4 hours together outside their cells. They no longer have to wear shackles every time they leave their tier. They're no longer forced to be in separate outdoor cages when exercising. And on our visit, we would see 4 men playing basketball while 2 guards stood watch. Roger's bet was that we would think of this arrangement as generous, though for me, it could only be understood relative to the reprehensible alternative that had been in place for so long. I had spent years calling the death penalty inhumane, but only began to truly understand how inhumane when I saw the table in Angola upon which it is carried out. I had taught writing and literature in prisons for years, but had never seen a place as difficult to write about as the Red Hat cell block. I was confronted with that feeling when the bus pulled up to death row, which was separate from the execution chamber. The pathway to the front door of death row was polluted by a spiral of barbed wire on either side. Inside was a front desk that looked as if it might be the front desk of any office building during the holidays. Christmas decorations were strewn across the wall in November. To the right was a door that opened into a vestibule, sterile and silent, like an abandoned hospital wing. The bottoms of our shoes squeaked against the clean tile floor as we were led down into the antechamber. This experience, more than any other at Angola, is the most difficult to fully recount, as I felt pulled out of my own body in the few short minutes we spent there. The death row unit was set up like a small single-floor panopticon, the dull colors of the room holding the light hostage. A round control room sat at the center of the unit, with large clear windows that would allow the guards to observe everything that surrounded it. From that room, correctional officers could see into each of the tiers on the unit, sections that extended outward from the center, like the legs of a large steel spider. In the reflection of the glass surrounding the control room, I could see a ghostly outline of my body staring back at me. There were about 70 men total on death row, and each of the tiers held approximately 12 people, each in individual cells. In between the tiers and the control room was a circular path that allowed for constant observation. It took only about a minute to walk around the entire unit. The space was small and compact, and we were a carousel of cautious bodies, uncertain of how to move inside of it. We had arrived during the period of time when the men were allowed out of their cells, 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon, but had to stay on their tier. As we walked around the unit, we could see into each tier, and they could see us. Some of the men were doing calisthenics. Some were talking to one another and looking out of the windows on the tier. Some were on a computer. Some were on the phone. As we walked by each of them, they looked in our direction. Some waved. Some smiled. Others didn't. It felt like a profound invasion of privacy to be there, unannounced, walking around in what was essentially their home. And yet, I wanted to come across as amicable, to wave back when waved to. The group tacitly settled on nodding to those we passed and keeping our collective silence. The air seemed too fragile for anything else. We circled the room, walking clockwise, so each time we looked to the right, we were followed by the faint reflections of our bodies in the glass panes of the control room. I could not help but feel that something rancid had settled inside of me, like my presence made me complicit in what was happening here. The incessant, multidimensional surveillance tightened my chest. Before I could fully come to terms with the gravity of where we were, the humanity of who we were seeing, we were quickly ushered out, leaving the men behind. My eyes narrowed as they adjusted to the light outside. Right before we got on the bus, a voice emerged from behind us. "Norris, is that you?" Norris turned around, smiled, and then embraced a man dressed in the attire all incarcerated people at Angola wore, and whose name I did not catch. They laughed and patted each other on the back, and Norris promised they would catch up more during his next visit. Being with Norris over the course of these hours made it clear how much he meant to the people who remained incarcerated inside Angola. Every person we walked by knew him by name, and he knew theirs, their faces glowing when they saw him. It was evident how much he was part of the recent history of the institution, and that his work meant so much to so many people there. It was evident how much he was a part of the recent history of the institution, and that his work meant so much to so many of the people there. "It's challenging when I leave, because I'm leaving people that I care about," he told me. "It's like some folks are there who I met when I first got there, and they're still there after I'm gone. That's the hardest part about it, seeing people and finding out about other folks who may have passed on." The average sentence at Angola is 87 years. "I know I inspire them," he continued, "but at the same time, they give me the energy to keep fighting, because I know what I'm fighting for. It's right in front of my face, so that's what keeps me there. It lets me know exactly why I'm in this fight and why it's so important to stay in this fight." As we drove toward the exit of the prison, the sun cast a late autumn shadow of our bus along the fields. From the window, we saw a group of 24 men in white and blue sweatshirts with garden hose methodically rising in their hands and then falling to the earth. Their bodies were set against a backdrop of trees that had tumbled into autumn, draping them in a volcanic sea of red and orange. It had been one thing to see black men laboring in the fields of Angola in photographs, but it was quite different to see it in person. The parallel with chattel slavery made it feel as if time was bending in on itself. There was no need for metaphor. The land made it literal. I wanted so desperately to ask the bus driver to stop, to be able to get off the bus and go speak with these men. I don't know what I would have said. I wanted voices to add texture to the images these men had become. I wanted them to be more than their bodies, more than flesh and fields and tools and emblems of history no one here seemed willing to sit with. I did not want to remember them as silence. But as quickly as we saw them, they began to recede. My neck craned and shifted, straining to keep them in sight of another moment. As we drove off, I watched them fade into the distance, their bodies melting into the gray sky, a throng of tangled silhouettes disappearing into the vast expanse of land. As we rode along the levee lining the river, the barrier that kept the prison from flooding during heavy storms, I looked out the window one last time and saw miles and miles of land bathed in the purple-orange hue of dusk. The earth resembled a quilt, patches of land crowned in cages, and patches of land made of quiet, open fields. A flock of birds, small and black, pushed and pulled against the sky as they moved in unison over the fields. They swerved and dipped and bent their bodies around each slice of wind, flying over the levees and toward the river, as if to look down and wonder, "What is a fence if you can fly right over it?" I turned and asked Norris, "How much did you get paid when you worked in the field?" "They gave folks an allowance. First 6 months when I came to prison, you didn't earn anything," he said. "The first 6 months, you're paying off all your clothes that we gotta give you while you're here." "Now go figure," Norris chuckled. "6 months going to pay for clothes for a lifetime." "But how much does someone make after the period is finished?" I asked. "Jobs in the field? 7 cents an hour." I leaned in, thinking I had misheard. "7 cents," Norris said again. "This place really is just like the plantation was. Just to utilize all the free labor that they can get," Norris continued. "They lost all that free labor to emancipation. And now, how are we going to get that free labor back? You got all these folks wandering around with no real skills. Don't know what to do. Well, we can create laws that put them back in servitude. And that's what they've done. Where do they work? They go right back to working convict leasing. Work in the same plantations that they were freed from." I asked Norris what stood out to him in his memories of the field. "Picking cotton," he responded, without any hesitation. "Man, it's like knowing your history, knowing what our folks went through, and all of a sudden, having one of these cotton sacks in your hand." He cupped his hand and then closed his fingers around the bag we were both imagining in his grasp. His knuckles were dark and cracked, and when he reopened his hand, he rubbed the inside of his palm with his thumb. "I think that's the biggest challenge more than anything else," he continued. "It was not the work, but just the mindset of being there and knowing you're kind of reliving history, in a sense. I'm going through the very same thing that folks fought and died for, so I wouldn't have to go through it. And here it is, all over again." Blandford Cemetery. I don't know if it's true or not, but I like it. Ken was tall and slender, with thick graying hair and a pair of glasses atop his forehead, ready, at any moment to, with a nod, drop down to his nose. Tours at the Blandford Cemetery were scheduled to begin every hour. At 9:55 a.m., I was the only person there. "Looks like it's just you and me," he said, smiling and rolling up his sleeves. The cemetery was as still as a cloudless sky. The soft din of lawnmowers buzzed in the distance, their vibrating bodies held by black men steering them in between tombstones draped in Confederate flags. The scent of freshly cut grass, a commingling of green blades and dry earth, swept across the field. The oldest marked grave at Blandford Cemetery dates back to 1702. But what this land is best known for took place more than a century and a half later. Buried here in Petersburg, Virginia, are the bodies of roughly 30,000 Confederate soldiers, one of the largest mass graves of Confederate servicemen in the South. I walked through this field and observed the names carved into each ashen tablet. James, Wright, Cotman. I did not know if they were first names or last names, soldiers who fought in the Civil War, or their descendants. It was a cemetery full of bodies that have long watched over this land, and of newly buried bodies just becoming acquainted with the earth. The entrance to the cemetery was marked by a large stone archway ornamented with the words, "Our Confederate Heroes," and two smaller archways on either side of it. Two Confederate flags sat at the bottom of the columns framing the main archway and flapped gently in the wind. The first dragonflies of spring whipped through the light breeze, their translucent wings pulsing against the warm air, their unbridled bodies somersaulting past one another. The first dragonflies of spring whipped through the light breeze, their translucent wings pulsing against the warm air, their unbridled bodies somersaulting past one another. I watched them dance through the air, land atop a headstone, and pause. I watched their wings twitch once, twice, then take off again, their bodies governed by the wind. I watched, and somewhat mystically, wondered whether these might have been descendants of dragonflies that flew over this land during the war more than a century and a half ago. I imagined them zipping past bullets that turned men into ghosts, their wings warm with beads of blood. I imagined them landing on top of bodies that were strewn on top of bodies, circling the smoke billowing from burning soil. Ken looked down at his black watch. It was 10 a.m. He led me out of the visitor center and up a set of stone stairs toward the church. The Blandford Church is a russet brick building with a festoon of tombstones in front of it. It was built as an Anglican church, part of the Church of England, but as the city of Petersburg grew, largely because of its proximity to the Appomattox River, which was a central means of trade throughout the region, the congregation decided in 1806 that they wanted to move to a more central location in the city. In order to do so, however, they had to go through a process of deconsecration, in which they formally declared that the building was no longer a church. When they do that, doors, floors, pulpit, pews, windows, all come out of this building. It is totally gutted, Ken said. The church, then a brick shell of itself, sat largely abandoned for 95 years. I want to jump forward, Ken said, as a couple that had arrived late hustled up the hill to join us. Ken welcomed them, shared a brief summary of what he had previously said, and began telling the story of how this land was transformed into one of the largest cemeteries in the state. A year after the Civil War, there's a young lady in town named Nora Davidson. She is very much a daughter of the Confederacy, said Ken. Davidson was headmistress at a school for young women, and she took students to Blandford Cemetery to put flowers and flags on the graves of Confederate soldiers the year after the war. She was part of a group of women who, as Ken put it, were disappointed because they felt that the Southern soldier had not been treated with the same dignity and honor that the Northern soldiers had. Southern soldiers, often when they fought and died, were buried where they fell. The South didn't have the resources to take you back to Georgia or Maryland or Texas or North Carolina. The ladies felt they wanted to do something about this, so they formed something called the Ladies Memorial Association. Their mission was to exhume the bodies of the Confederate soldiers they could find and bring them into this now larger cemetery and rebury them, he said. The Petersburg Ladies Memorial Association was one of many that organized throughout the South in the aftermath of the Civil War, hiring laborers to find bodies and rebury them in Confederate cemeteries. Well, Ken said, it took them 15 years. He dabbed at a line of sweat on his forehead with the edge of his sleeve. They found almost 30,000 sets of Confederate remains. But, Ken said, there was a problem. Most of the bodies exhumed were not identifiable. New forms of artillery had been introduced during the Civil War that men's bodies ravaged in a way that had previously been unseen in standard warfare. Sometimes, all that was left was a leg or an arm or a head with no body attached. The trouble with the Civil War soldier was there was no standard identification. No one wore dog tags. No one had ID bands, Ken said. Of the roughly 30,000 soldiers buried at Blandford, only about 2,200 are identified. After 15 years of collecting the remains, the women decided they needed a focal point around which to dedicate the cemetery. The city of Petersburg gave them the old church, which had been all but abandoned for almost a century, to refurbish the building and make it into a living memorial to the slain Confederate soldiers. The Ladies Memorial Association commissioned Tiffany Studios, owned by the world-renowned artist and specialist in stained glass windows, Lewis Comfort Tiffany, to lead this project. As Ken continued talking, I briefly swiped open my phone and looked it up. Lewis Comfort Tiffany was part of the famous New York Tiffany family, and it was his father who had started the company Tiffany & Co. The problem for the Ladies Memorial Association was that the women could not afford to pay a company as renowned as Tiffany's to complete the project. In 1901, Mr. Tiffany sold a window like that, this size, for $1,700. If you do the math, that is $49,000 in today's equivalent dollars, Ken said. And the Ladies Memorial Association needed more than a dozen windows. But ultimately, Tiffany Studios gave the women a discount. Only $350 per window, a much more manageable price, but still prohibitive for the organization. So the solution was, they would go to the Confederate states and the border states and say, if you raise this money, we will put in a window in your honor in this memorial for the Southern soldier. And that's how all the windows got populated, Ken said, waving his hands as if they held magic wands. Ken grabbed a pair of keys from his pocket and fidgeted with the door of the church before pushing it open. As we stepped inside the church, a hazy darkness wrapped around my skin. At first, all I could see were the silhouettes of old pews and rings of stained glass windows traced by sunlight. As my eyes adjusted, the contours of the room became more distinct and the images in the windows sharpened. Each stained glass window was a mesmerizing display of craftsmanship, a canvas of dazzling blues and greens and violets exploding from each pane. On each window stood a Christian saint surrounded by a burst of colors, the texture of the glass making it seem as if the pious figures were stepping out from the thick panels. Three things in the window: seal, figure, and inscription, Ken said, approaching the first window nearest the door, a towering, magnificent piece of glass with St. Mark holding a scroll and looking into the distance. Each window commemorating a state's soldiers depicts a saint, and with a state seal at the top of the window and an inscription at the bottom. Below St. Mark, written in black in a golden box, was, to the glory of God and in memory of South Carolina's sons who died for the Confederacy, he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. In the other windows were the saints Bartholomew, Paul, John, Peter, James the Less, Philip, Thomas, Matthew, Luke, and Andrew. Beneath each of them were inscriptions praising the valor of the Confederate soldiers who fought in the war. My eyes moved back and forth from the image of the saint to the inscription under their feet, the dissonance growing with every second. Ken went on to outline the aesthetic history of each window in the church with meticulous detail, making his way from window to window, reciting his practice presentation with precision and depth. There was little discussion, however, of anything beyond the windows. I asked Ken if many of the people who visited these grounds and came on these tours were Confederate sympathizers. I think there's a Confederate empathy, he said, altering the language slightly. You're here primarily for the beauty of the windows, but a lot of people don't know about it, and a lot of people who do come have Confederate empathy. People will tell you, my great-great-grandmother, my great-great-grandfather are buried out here. So they've got long Southern roots, which go back into the 1860s and before. He shuffled the keys in his hand, looking for the one that would lock the church door. But an awful lot of people come from Michigan and Minnesota and Montana because they want to see the beauty of the windows. I tried to be more direct. I asked Ken how he personally, and Blanford as an institution, thought about addressing the history and symbolism of Confederate iconography in the church and throughout the cemetery. Was it okay to only talk about the windows and not to say anything about the Confederate cause they were built to honor? Very simple, Ken responded. As they say, you're not from around here. I'm not a Southerner. I didn't quite understand what Ken was saying. My father was in the military, so I was raised primarily north of the Mason-Dixon line. So I don't have the Southern upbringing. I don't have the War of Northern Aggression or the States' Rights War, he said, referring to the alternate names the Civil War is sometimes called by those sympathetic to the Confederate cause. Is it possible that this church in 1735 may have been built probably with slave labor? Absolutely. When the balcony was used up here and the congregation was small, did slaves stay up there? Perhaps. Ken said that the lack of discussion around these topics was potentially tied to the demographic makeup of the cemetery's visitors. Our visitor population is overwhelmingly white, because again, what this is, it's not that a black population doesn't appreciate the windows, but sometimes in the context of what it represents, they're not as comfortable. He went on, in most cases, we try and fall back on the beauty of the windows, the Tiffany glass kind of thing. Perhaps it was not simply that black people did not come to a Confederate cemetery because they didn't want to be in the space. Perhaps black people did not come to these spaces in large part because of how the story of the Confederate cause was told. I was tempted to tell Ken about the Whitney Plantation, how a great many people assumed that black Americans would have no interest in visiting the land upon which their ancestors were enslaved, but my visit to the Whitney had shown me that if a place was willing to tell a different story, a more honest story, it would begin to see a different set of people visiting. For me, coming to a Confederate cemetery and hearing Ken speak about the beauty of a set of windows without exploring what they were meant to memorialize was not unlike going to a plantation and listening to a talk about the decorative infrastructure of the enslaver's house without mentioning the enslaved hands who built it. We stepped back into the visitor building, filled by a late morning light that showered each glass encasement housing pieces of the cemetery's history. Ken pointed to a woman behind the counter. "She's my boss," he said, in what felt like an attempt to pass me off to someone else, or at least to share the burden of questions I was throwing his way. At this point, the woman came over and stood just a few feet away from Ken. She smiled, and I smiled back. Martha had a kind face with large tortoiseshell glasses that sat high on her nose. I asked her if the cemetery was concerned that, by presenting Blanford in such a positive light, they might be distorting its connection to an army and a cause that was violent, racist, and treasonous. "Absolutely," she said. "And when people ask, I've been here for 18 years, people often ask, what do I personally feel is the true cause? And I say, well, you get five different historians who have written five different books, I'm going to have five different answers. It's a lot of stuff. But I think from my perspective, of my ancestors, it was not slavery. My ancestors were not slaveholders. But my great-great-grandfather fought. He had federal troops coming into Norfolk. He said, nah, I've got to join the army and defend my home state. And that's what he did. It was not a slavery issue, but that's just for that particular individual. I always try to tell people, it's a lot of things that came together." She continued, "It was interesting. When I came to work in the church, my whole point is to learn about the interesting early history and talk about what the women did. Again, as a woman, I like to talk about women's history and say they've been through a lot, but this is how they helped to get through their grief of perhaps a husband, father, son dying, trying to take care of those remains. Because, again, the federal government took care of the Union Army. There was nothing done for the Confederates, so it was important to them. And this is what their result was, this beautiful chapel. To think you can walk in there, and as Ken was saying, just enjoy this little Anglican church that is restored to this beautiful chapel. I think you could take the Civil War aspect totally out of it, and enjoy the beauty." I made a note of Martha's invocation of her lineage as the starting point of our conversation. It did not feel incidental, but central to how she thought about the war and what it represented. "You were talking about how, for a lot of people, they can come in here and just see the windows and appreciate the history and decor of the church," I said. "But for me, as someone who is a black American, someone whose ancestors were enslaved, it is very difficult for me to disentangle any of it. I think there's a profound dissonance even to be here. I've never been to a Confederate cemetery except at this moment." Ken walked back in our direction. "I think I experience it probably in a very different way than a lot of your visitors." As I said all of this, Martha and Ken nodded. "Unfortunately, we don't often get that," Ken said. "What would you guess, Martha? 85-90% of our visitors are white?" Martha nodded. "If I had to guess, I imagine that even that number was understating the percentage of white visitors." Ken stepped away again, and I continued my conversation with Martha. As we spoke, I looked down at the counter where handouts for a Memorial Day event hosted by the Sons of Confederate Veterans were piled up. My focus trailed off. Martha's words became an indecipherable din as I reached down and grabbed one. Martha's gaze followed the direction of my hand. Her face turned red, and she thrust her hand down quickly to flip the paper, covering the rest of the leaflets. "Don't even look at this. I'm sorry," she said nervously. "I will tell you that from a personal standpoint, I'm kind of bothered." I looked at the flyer again, this time focusing on the photograph of the guest speaker for the event. Paul C. Grambling, Jr., then the Commander-in-Chief of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. "I don't mind that they come on Memorial Day and put Confederate flags on Confederate graves. That's okay," she said. "But as far as I'm concerned, you don't need a Confederate flag on..." She stumbled over a series of sentences I couldn't follow. Then she collected herself and took a deep breath. "I hate the fact that people use that as in-your-face kind of stuff," she said. "If you're just talking about history, it's great. But these folks are like, the South shall rise again. It's very bothersome. It's peaceful, but I went to one because I was invited and wanted to see, and I said I will never do it again. These folks can't let things go. I mean, it's not like they want people enslaved again, but they can't get over the fact that history is history." Martha started talking to me about how preservation was different from celebration, an idea that made sense to me in the abstract. I asked Martha for her opinion on the Confederate monuments in Richmond that had gotten so much attention since the 2017 white nationalist rally in Charlottesville. "I would like to see the monument staying up, but with context," she said. "Because, again, I understand where people are coming from, but if we can't have them where they are, we've got to have them somewhere. The thing is, my personal opinion, and I will tell you this, I don't think that Robert E. Lee would have been pleased with all this deitizing. He was a very humble person. I don't think he'd be happy at all with the controversy," she said. "He did what he thought was right. He did do an awful lot. Again, he was in the U.S. Army before he took on the Confederate States of America, the CSA. But I, just from personally reading things about him, I don't think he'd be happy at all to know about all these statues of him everywhere. I don't think he'd be happy to know that there's a controversy about Monument Avenue, because he was just much more humble than that." More people were coming into the visitor center, and I didn't want to keep either of them from their work. I thanked Ken and Martha for their time. We shook hands, and I made my way out of the door, the wind slapping against the thousands of tombstones around me. I thought about Martha's admiration for Robert E. Lee and her assertion that he would not have liked the statues that had been raised in his name. Perhaps Martha was right, as Lee's words suggest that he likely would not have advocated for Confederate monuments to be erected. In an August 1869 letter he wrote, "I think it wiser, moreover, not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife, to commit to oblivion the feelings engendered." Lee's hesitancy to erect memorials after the war, however, should not be considered exculpatory or a reflection of his desire to move toward an egalitarian society in which black people were equal to their white counterparts. As historian Kevin M. Levin notes, Lee remained outwardly reconciled to defeat, but privately, he was troubled about emancipation and the end of slavery. Robert E. Lee was a slave owner who led an army predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery. A letter Lee wrote to his wife in 1856 is often used as a means of demonstrating that Lee couldn't have fought for the Confederacy in order to protect slavery because he believed that slavery was, quote, a moral and political evil. Devoid of additional context and an acknowledgement of the fact that Lee owned enslaved people, this assertion might seem to shield Lee from allegations of racism and bigotry. And yet, two sentences later, it reads, "I think it, however, a greater evil to the white man than to the black race, and while my feelings are strongly enlisted in behalf of the latter, my sympathies are more strong for the former. The blacks are immeasurably better off here than in Africa, morally, socially, and physically. The painful discipline they are undergoing is necessary for their instruction as a race, and I hope will prepare and lead them to better things. How long their subjugation may be necessary is known and ordered by a wise and merciful providence. Their emancipation will sooner result from the mild and melting influence of Christianity than the storms and tempest of fiery controversy. While Lee believed that slavery would one day come to an end, he also seemed to believe it was up to God when that happened. It was a view common of those in Lee's world. He and his fellow enslavers had no control over it. Everyone, including the enslaved, were simply meant to wait for divine intervention. As a slave owner, Lee was ruthless in breaking up families. According to historian Elizabeth Brown Pryor, by 1860, he had broken up every family but one on the estate. When three of Lee's enslaved workers escaped, he had them hunted down, and when they were returned, had them beaten in a spectacle of cruelty. A testimony from one of the people who attempted to escape reads, "We were immediately taken before General Lee, who demanded the reason why we ran away. We frankly told him that we considered ourselves free. He then told us he would teach us a lesson we would never forget. He then ordered us to the barn, where, in his presence, we were tied firmly to posts by Mr. Gwynn, our overseer, who was ordered by General Lee to strip us to the waist and give us 50 lashes each, excepting my sister, who received but 20. We were accordingly stripped to the skin by the overseer who, however, had sufficient humanity to decline whipping us. Accordingly, Dick Williams, a county constable, was called in, who gave us the number of lashes ordered. General Lee, in the meantime, stood by and frequently enjoined Williams to lay it on well, an injunction which he did not fail to heed. Not satisfied with simply lacerating our naked flesh, General Lee then ordered the overseer to thoroughly wash our backs with brine, which was done. During the war, Lee was, like his contemporaries, disturbed by the sight of black soldiers in Union ranks. White soldiers under his command ruthlessly executed black soldiers who attempted to surrender during the infamous Battle of the Crater, the first time Lee's Army of Northern Virginia had faced large numbers of black troops. The Battle of the Crater is helpful not only in contextualizing Lee, but in contextualizing the cemetery itself. You can connect this directly to the Blandford Cemetery, Levin later told me. The Confederate counterattack that pushed back the Union advance, including an entire division of black soldiers,